G'day and welcome to the Car Expert Podcast. My name is Sean and we're back here for another week. Apologies, this is coming out on a Tuesday. We had to stop some filming things around this week, so we are a day late, but we're not a dollar short. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about today. Scott and James are back. How you doing, guys?
Living the dream as always.
Yeah, a bit weird to be doing this. Yeah, a bit weird doing this on a Tuesday, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels like a Monday today.
Well, I promise you, it's not going to be that long of a week. We're going to get into it. Before we start, I do have a quick public service announcement I'd like to talk about. So I went to Sydney on the weekend, and I think we can all agree, Sydney Domestic Airport's one of the worst airports in the country. If it's raining, it's leaking. If it's busy, you just can't do anything.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess.
And if you're running late enough, you can't land at all.
Yes. Yes. So, but the thing is, you used to just walk across the street into the car park and pick up a rental car. Mm-hmm. Now you have to catch a shuttle bus to the very back of the airport to get it because that car park is being demolished. It takes like, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes to get the shuttle bus around there. You have to make multiple stops. And then you have to wait in a queue at this like car park out the back blocks of Sydney Airport. If you're coming back and there's traffic, the buses don't use the bus lanes. So it took me 40 minutes to get from there to the airport. Nearly missed check-in for my flight. Like literally dropped my bag with 30 seconds before they closed bag check. So my consumer advice is if you want to fly to Sydney Airport, don't. But if you have to and you need to rent a car, book it at one of the off-site airport rental car agencies nearby because it's about a five-minute Uber ride down the road. You don't get stung the Sydney Airport surcharge for renting a car there. So it's cheaper, it's quicker to get, and you'll be at the airport sooner than you would be if you went to the airport rental cars. So
critical question, what was your rental car?
It was a Polestar 2.
Was it really?
It was, yeah. So funny thing, well, we won't linger on this too long, but basically, as we know, Hertz went, we're going to buy all the electric cars in the world. And then we went, we're going to sell all the electric cars. So to rent a Suzuki Swift for the weekend was like $250. And to rent the Polestar was about $170.
Wow, that's pretty telling.
And I didn't have to recharge it. I took it back with around 70% charge and they didn't charge me for it. So it didn't have to be juiced back up to 100% or anything. So yeah, if you want to test drive an electric car, check out Hertz. Okay, but we're going to get into today's podcast. Today, we're going to talk about the Porsche Taycan Turbo GT, or as I like to call it, the Porsche Say Goodbye to Your License. We're going to talk about a new electric Alfa Romeo, and we're going to be talking about the Mahindra Scorpio that we've actually got in the office as a long-term at the moment. So all that to come. Let's dive into the Porsche, though. As I said, the Porsche Say Goodbye to Your License, because it does 0 to 200 kilometers an hour in 6.4 seconds.
That is just insane. I had to double, triple check that when I was reading Alborz's review because it seemed wrong. It used to be that a 5 or a 6 second car to 100 was fast. I do have a question though, and that is which one of us doesn't get to come along? Because this thing doesn't have any rear seats when you get the Visac pack and it's a four-door, four-seat car.
Yes. So for those who don't know, the Taycan is Porsche's electric sedan.
Yep.
I guess it's the fully electric version of, Panamera or
a little bit smaller, like that. But fundamentally it's their, I suppose their Tesla Model S rival. Not the Model S in Australia anymore. Yeah. It's sort of a usable family four-door, but it's not a massive limousine.
Yeah, so the old one did the Nürburgring in like 7.5 minutes. This Taycan Turbo GT has done the Nürburgring in 7 minutes, 7.55 seconds. It's 26 seconds faster than the last one. They shaved 70 kilos out, between 50 and 70 kilos out of it by removing the rear seats and some other things. Mm. And it's now got 760 kilowatts if you use launch control, which is just
insane.
It's just wild. Who wants to take a guess at how much it costs?
I know you've told us this, but I actually haven't done my preparation. So I'm going to take a punt. I reckon what you pay theoretically 350 something for a GT4 RS before options and stuff. And I can't imagine people are going to pay more for this than they are a Cayman GT4 RS. So I'm going to say 300 grand.
Okay, James, have you got a number? Just throw out a number.
Maybe like 400.
James is the closest.
Really?
It's 416,000 before you get into options.
And isn't the Visac pack like 20 or 30 grand
it's
or something?
It's a fair lick more. Yeah. But to be fair, the Visac pack does take 0.2 of a second out of your 0 to 200 kilometer an hour time. I mean, Formula One teams spend millions getting tents out, so that's pretty good value for money, really.
I do have a question to you guys about this. I love Porsches. I've been very open about that on the podcast and on the website as well, in the same way James has a Golf GTI.
Does James have a Golf GTI?
I don't quite get this car. And for me, that GT3, GT4, GT3 RS thing has always been, let's take a sports car and make it wilder. I get that this is a different product and I get that in the electric age, the motorsports division needs something to do. They still have expertise to share, but it does always seem to me that when they've taken a car previously, they've built on its strengths. You know, a GT3 RS is better on track than a GT3, which is better on track than a GTS. I don't know quite where this car fits, because if you want the full-on turbo GT, you get the Vysac pack, but then it's not a very good family car because it's got no rear seats. And if you don't want the Vysac pack, well, why would you bother buying the turbo GT? You might as well just buy a turbo, which is already obscenely fast in a straight line, but looks a little bit straighter, is cheaper obviously to buy as well, and seems to make more sense as a family car.
Mm. It is an interesting thing. So it, look, put it this way, it's half the price of a 911 GT2 RS, for instance.
I suppose so, yeah.
And it's probably a bit quicker because it's 2.30 to 100, which is, I think, 0.2 of a second faster than a Model S Plaid. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty bloody quick. So look, you can have two of them for the price of a GT2 RS, which I guess there's not a 992 GT2 RS yet.
Not yet, no.
But it will come. It probably costs more than the old one did. But it is, I'm curious about, is this like the future of track weapons? Because for the years and years, we've seen these stripped out versions of cars. Alfa did it with the Quadrifoglio, the...
Quadrifoglio.
Quadrifoglio, yes.
The Quadrifoglio, I think, is a pizza.
It is, you're right. The Alfa had the, what was the GTV? Yeah. They stripped everything out of it and did that. Ferrari have done it for years. You could buy the FXXXXKX, whatever it is.
Jaguar had the Project 8. BMW does the CS.
So now Porsche doing it with the electric car. I can't think of any other EVs that have this, that are doing this just yet. But is this where we're headed, you reckon? Are we going to see more of this sort of wild track-focused EV?
Yeah, I think what this is really just Porsche signaling that it can be done. And I think, unfortunately, for the Taycan, they're only like dedicated electric vehicle for now until the new Macan comes in. And I think the Macan's probably not as well positioned to take this role. And we know that Porsche is working on, I think, an electric 718 successor. So, you know, this, a lot of this stuff could be the next Cayman GT4, for example. It's just in their current electric car. So as much as I understand Scott's points that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, I think that it's just Porsche saying we can and we will. So if you want it, buy it. And I think, you know, the purple hero color looks sick. I love how it looks, and you can sort of choose whether you want one with rear seats or you want one that's all an all-out track monster. But like, just the numbers are fascinating. So I think it's just, yeah, a cool little flex piece.
I would love to get one side by side with a Hyundai Ioniq 5N on the track.
Yeah, I don't know whether the Ioniq would be able to stand up to those numbers.
I don't know whether it would, but I don't know that that's the point either. I feel like a track car, obviously it needs to be fast and focused, right? Because you're not just going to drive a wallowing barge around a track. But you don't go to track days necessarily to prove you're a V8 supercar driver. You go to track days to enjoy your car in a way you can't on the road. And the Ioniq 5N, with its gearing, with its interesting noises and that sort of thing, although it is still fearsomely fast, and we'll see more of that on the channel eventually.
It should be out on the channel now if you're watching this after Tuesday.
Oh, really?
We actually have our Ioniq 5N 2 videos dropping Tuesday, and yeah, they'll be on the channel. So we'll put a link in the description for those who want to watch those, but yeah, go on.
But there's some really clever stuff going on to make it feel fun on the track beyond just scary fast, lose your stomach quick, you know, light, no rear seats, that sort of thing. I wonder if maybe that's the future. And I do also wonder if Porsche, which is a brand that does things for engineering reasons, maybe needs to lose that mindset a little bit with cars like the Turbo GT and actually artificially engineer in a bit of fun, which is not something it's had to do previously because cars have just done it.
Well, you could get four Ioniq 5Ns for the price of the Porsche. But, you know, I think you're right. I think because the Ioniq 5N feels like they went to a racetrack and asked a bunch of eight-year-olds, what do you want to see?
Yeah.
And that's how they came up with that car, whereas this is like, I mean, it's the ethos of a Porsche, right?
Absolutely. It is the most.
Precision, it is the fastest, the best handling. Yeah, I'd be curious to see things like the KTM Crossbow and stuff, if they start to go electric, what that's like a proper track car, what's going to happen when they do it, so.
Yeah. I've actually driven, sorry, I know you're about to
that's okay.
There is a company called Kibbutz, and they build electric postie bikes.
I've heard of these. Yeah, right. They do great jumps, apparently.
So they're, I'm sure they do. They're a Swiss company. They're based outside of Zurich. And in Australia, they're on the roads. Those sort of three-wheeled trikes with a little roof on them made by Kibbutz. They also make a roofless electric sports car. It's called the E-Rod. And in a past life, two jobs ago, I actually got to drive it on the roads around Zurich. Call it Mazda MX-5 Fast. It was freezing. I didn't bring a helmet or goggles, and it was about 3 degrees outside. So that was not very good planning from me. But there is definitely potential in that formula based on what Kibbutz is doing. And I'd love to see yeah, I mean, when Porsche eventually starts doing an electric 718 or even the MG Cyberstep down the track, there is potential there for track-only cars, for convertibles to do, I suppose, things a little differently to what we expect at the moment. But the focus has got to be on fun and drivers. It can't just be on straight line.
Yeah. All right. There you go. So if you're thinking of buying a track car, would you consider an electric one? Let us know in the comments. All right. It's time to talk about one of the world's oldest car brands going electric. I mean, if you are an Alfa Romeo enthusiast, and I think we all grew up watching Top Gear, and one of the things on that was you can't be a car enthusiast if you haven't owned an Alfa Romeo, right? But does that still count if the Alfa is fully electric? Will it break down as often? Will you spend as much time on the road? Will there be no oil leaks, I suppose?
Are there any other stereotypes we need to get out of the way?
No, there probably is, but okay. As we come to it, I'll point out.
Fashion.
Yes. So Alfa late last week actually announced a new electric car called the Alyssa Milano.
Just in case anyone wasn't aware, what was it actually called?
The Milano, right. Named after the famous Italian city. And then the Italian government said, nope, right. There's a law against that. For reasons that Scott will explain, and it's now called the Junior, which is, I feel like, Scott, you can elaborate on this a little bit because the story is a bit outlandish.
So everyone would be familiar, I assume, watching this with the idea that champagne has to come from champagne. Parmesan cheese is a particular type of cheese from a particular place. It's made a certain way. And I think even Greek feta has to come from Greece. Italy has similar laws. If you want to call something after an Italian city, it has to be produced or majority produced there. And Alfa Romeo is building this car in Poland. It says that it saves 10,000 euro or about 15 or 16,000 Australian dollars per car by doing that instead of building it in Italy.
It's a lot of money.
And the Italian government's come out and said you can't call it the Milano on the back of that. I have some questions about that because Stellantis, which is the parent company, is headquartered in the Netherlands, which is a tax, let's call it, haven. Stellantis is made up of French, Italian and American brands that do partnerships with Japanese brands in certain markets like Toyota. Before that, Alfa Romeo was part of Fiat Chrysler, which was a partnership between an Italian and an American brand. The Milano underneath is built on the Peugeot E2008's platform, which is French, but it's also American because it's under the Jeep Avenger.
But that's made in Italy.
Which is made in Italy.
So where's the whiteboard? I'm going to write all this down.
I understand that obviously Italy wants to protect its heritage and you can't just call something Italian when it's not.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of layers to this car that are very global. It does seem kind of funny to me. The Italian government's gone, all this other stuff is okay with one of our iconic brands. Just don't call it the Milano.
Yeah. So the Alfa Romeo Allied Powers circa 1944.
No.
I know we said we weren't going to mention the war, but I had to do it.
It's also going to change sides halfway through.
Look, it is an interesting little car though. I mean, it's a small SUV. It's Alfa's first sort of foray into fully electric. They've got the hybrid Tonale out. There's a plug-in version,
Mild hybrid plug-in version of the Tonale, and the Junior, formerly Milano, will also have a mild hybrid version in select markets as well.
But the electric version, it's going to have a 54 kilowatt hour battery, which is, you know, so it makes it, like, it's obviously targeted at city lifestyle sort of thing. The looks are interesting. I find the looks quite interesting because to me it looks a lot like a VinFast VF8. I know that Alfa Romeo would be very unhappy hearing that.
Sacrilege.
I mean, it does, but what do you guys think of how it looks?
I actually was pleasantly surprised by the looks because we saw a few teasers and leaks and things like that in the lead up to the reveal. And then when I saw the photos, it kind of reminded me, what was that car that we spoke about? It was like, there was this funny blocky Alfa.
Oh, the SZ.
The SZ. It reminds me of the SZ in the way that it's sort of wedge shaped and the way that there's like really bluff sides and even the front sort of had a similar face. So I thought if that's what they intended to do, I'm not sure if that's what they intended to do, but it was a nice homage to their previous designs because some brands make SUVs out of sports car nameplates and designs and then sort of muck it up. Whereas I think this is still looked quite cool and it looked tangibly different enough to the other vehicles based on this platform where you can sort of see some similarities in terms of like the switches and the buttons, but other than that it looks almost like a bespoke product, and that's something, a risk that a lot of brands do with platform sharing. So the specs look cool, I think it looks nice. It'd be interesting to see how they price it here when it comes next year, but maybe the name change will make it cheaper.
I hope they get Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito to do the marketing for it because it's...
We could offer our services. We could. As a tall man and a short man.
Yeah, I'll be Danny DeVito. I'm fine with that. Okay, and now this is a game that James wanted to play. So we're going to open up. We want to know what cars can you think of that were named after cities or places? Now, I'm going to put some rules in here. Kia and Hyundai are out because all of their cars are named after cities and places.
Oh, okay. That does make it hard.
It does, because I always just name the entire Hyundai range.
But I think the Sorrento has one R and not two, so it's not named after the Italian city because of these laws.
Or the Melbourne city.
Yeah, exactly.
But okay, so we're taking out Kia and Hyundai. What other, I guess let's call it like, not let's not go like bespoke little cars, sort of like bigger cars, popular cars were named after places. What can you think of?
Well, Peugeot's range is named after postcodes.
Oh, is that where the name's from?
No.
I was going to go the Peugeot Sydney postcode, Melbourne postcode, and South Australia postcode.
That's where the 3008 came from. Yeah. The Docklands.
I'm going to give you a serious answer. The Ferrari 458 Italia, for me, is the most obvious because they didn't pick a city. They just named it after the whole country.
Yep.
There is also, in Alfa Romeo, the Mito, which is Milano Turin, or Torino, which is where it was designed and built, I believe. Something along those lines.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, well, the Hyundai. Oh, no, you said no Hyundai.
No, no Hyundai. So this was your idea, this game.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you just name all the Hyundais.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think.
Cupra loves it. The Formentor is named after Formentora, which is an island off the coast of Spain.
Right. Yeah.
I think Ateca is also a place in Spain.
Yeah, Ateca is a place. Bourne is a place as well. And León, I think. Yeah, all of the Cupra range is named after places in Spain. I'm trying to think of other ones.
There's not a huge amount. I mean, you start going into some of the American brands. Chevrolet obviously have Tahoe.
Yeah.
Yeah, the American
the
brands.
GMC, Sierra.
Yeah, Sierra. Yeah. So there's a lot of Denali, all those sort of things. They're places like mostly deserts. So they've taken the Apple naming system and done it with their cars. It is funny, isn't it? It is funny how companies come up with names because sometimes they make a lot of sense. Mm. And you can look at the Hyundai range. They moved into the American market and they're like, well, name it after places in America. Yeah. People will recognize the name and they'll buy the car. But then you have Toyota who go, let's have an electric car. We'll call it the BZ4X. And you're like, what does that mean? Where did that name come from?
We can be quite critical of alphabet soup. And it does feel like something that brands have done previously because they wanted to imitate the Germans. You know, a BMW 520i back in the day, there was a real logic to it. It was the five series two-liter engine.
Very simple.
Hyundai i30 doesn't really have the same heritage or history to it. It just kind of feels like 130i flipped.
Mm. Well, also they came out at the start of like the iPhone era. So everyone was like, oh, the Hyundai iPhone.
But I do think that there is something to naming a car after a place because it gives it some sort of emotion. And I suppose as well, you can see the inspiration there. It has to actually carry through. You can't call if you called the Hyundai Staria, instead it was called the Hyundai Sistine Chapel. That wouldn't make any sense. But the idea that this is an Italian car, it's designed a bit differently to the French and the American versions. It's got, you know, a classic jewel cowl hood and a beautiful sort of old style Alfa grille on it. Calling it the Milano does evoke an emotion. And as silly as we've been about the fact this is a very global car, I kind of like that Alfa tried. I think as well, it makes sense because it is a small city SUV, the sort of thing that would live somewhere like Milan, as opposed to calling a, you know, fairly soft roading car the Hyundai Simpson Desert or something like that, right? They've actually named it appropriately for what it's trying to do.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll give you a free kick on the Kia Tasman because I like that name because they're presumably, they're going to sell that in Australia and New Zealand.
It's very focused on Australia and New Zealand.
They've picked the name and they said, you know what, we're going to sell it on either side of the Tasman because if they named it after a sea near Korea, calling it the Kia South China Sea just wouldn't have the same appeal, would it?
You weren't determined to start war today, aren't you?
Yeah, I figure I may as well. I'm leaning into it. Well, yeah, I like naming cars. I like that idea. Holden Commodore is a good example because the Commodore was an individual, but also there were so many classic pubs that were called the Commodore Hotel. Mm. And that I think that reverberates with people, especially in Australia. Aussies like a good name that sticks in the back of their heads. So what is your favourite car name that was named after a place? I'll let the viewers at home, you can pick a Kia or Hyundai if you want. But what is your favourite car named after a place? Leave a comment below and let us know. We're going to stick with EVs for a second. I want to know what car you guys would buy that is an electrified sports car. This can be a hybrid, a plug-in hybrid, a fully electric. It could be the Taycan Turbo GT if you want it to be. It can be a RAV4 hybrid rental car, whatever you guys think. What is the electrified sports car that you would buy?
You're both looking at me.
Yeah, let's you go first, James. Go
on. I think the dream for me right now would be the Audi e-tron GT. I don't necessarily need the RS one, provided I could like bespoke build a base one with like the colors and trims that I wanted, because the current like standard palette's a little bit boring. But
the seven shades of gray that you can pick from out here.
Yeah, yeah. I loved how it's not as necessarily as flashy as the Porsche, because obviously the Porsche has the shape and the grip and the badge and everything, and you know, people perhaps know Taycan a lot more than they know e-tron GT, which is sort of a little bit of a fumbly name, but it just was one of the few EVs, probably before I drove the Ioniq 5N, that really felt special and something that you really wanted to drive. Like it makes you feel like a movie star. It drives beautifully. It's still an Audi at its core, and it's just like just a really nice thing, and it fit my tastes really well. So that's why I really enjoyed that car. So I'd probably get one of those.
What kind of mirrors would you have on it though?
I think that one you can't get the digital mirrors.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so
that's a good thing.
Yeah, so it's then it's all good.
Yeah, okay.
That works. There you go,
Scott. What about you?
I had a few different thoughts on this. I don't want an electric sports car. Okay. If I were buying a Taycan, I'd buy it because it's a really lovely family car. So I'm going a plug-in hybrid, which is very against my usual.
There's a lot of questions about this. Yeah. He's a changed man.
Not really. I've driven a McLaren Artura, mm-hmm. and I found it incredibly impressive. I've also heard incredible things about the Ferrari 296 GTB, but I'm actually going to go the Mercedes AMG C63 SE Performance.
A car you have driven.
I have driven, exactly. It is fast in a straight line. It handles like an overgrown CLA 45, but beyond all of that, it is the most complicated powertrain I think I've ever experienced. And the way they've made it all work together is really impressive. So I don't know that I want one more than the old V8. I still kind of covet one of those 63 W507 editions they did.
You can't beat that sound.
It's beautiful. But I am very impressed by what Merck's managed.
Okay, well, if you're struggling to choose an electrified sports car, we have a fantastic tool on our website called the Car Chooser. Head to Google, type in Help Me Car Expert, and you scroll down the page, you'll find the Car Chooser. You can select an electrified sports car, an electrified fun car, and might help you narrow down the choice that you're looking for. So Google Help Me Car Expert, and if you do use the Car Chooser and it helps you find your next car, leave a comment, let us know what it was. Okay, it is time to talk about our review this week. It's an interesting one, because normally we get cars in and we have them for, you know, 5 to 7 days, and then we get a bit of a steer around town and maybe we go out for a little drive in the country, but it's not often we actually get a car that we spend quite a bit of time driving, and it's not often we get a car that everyone in the office gets to have a drive of at the same time. So we're talking about the Mahindra Scorpio, not N, but it still says N on the dash, long-termer that we've got. So if you don't know what the Mahindra Scorpio is, it's a rugged little SUV that is fairly well packaged, costs around about $50,000, and comes out of India, which we went and checked out last year. You can check out the review. We've got a link in the description below. But Scott, you're the one that wanted to talk about this, so I'm going to hand it over to you and go nuts.
I wanted to talk about it because we've now had it for 2 months, something like that. We'll be driving it for another month, and it's actually your production car. Anyone who's watched our other videos on Car Expert knows we film at Lang Lang, which is about 2 hours from Melbourne.
It's a top secret location, just off the
freeway. Yeah, it's a car that's done a lot of kilometres with us behind the wheel now. So I suppose I wanted to check in on how you're enjoying it, because you drive it the most, and see, based on what you expected when we started, how it's performing. And I think a good place to start is on those Lang Lang drives. What does it do?
Well, it depends whether there's a crosswind or not. it's a very tall and thin car, yeah. So it's kind of like you. And if it gets a strong crosswind coming, it can be a little bit funny. It will throw it around the road a little bit. But for the most part, we had one when they first came out, and I remember driving it, and I was like, oh, this is fine. It does the job. I actually quite enjoy driving it on the highway. It's actually really quite pleasant once you get going. It's got enough power in it that it sort of just pulls itself along, sit at 100 k's an hour down the motorway. I'm quite surprised, especially considering, you know, I spent 3 months driving in Everest and doing the similar thing. And it doesn't feel that dramatically different to driving a big car like that. It's planted really nicely. It's quite comfortable. Suspension's good. It's just, it does feel a little bit small inside. And I think that's the thing that I find a little bit strange. When I load in all my kit and then I'm driving and passing trucks and things like that, you certainly feel that it's a lot smaller than an Everest, for argument's sake.
So when you're loading in all your kit, our Scorpio has got 6 seats in the interior. Mahindra does offer it overseas, I think, with 7, but we don't get that here. Is that right?
Yeah, I think because it's only got a lap seat belt.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so it has captain's chairs in the second row, which is kind of nice, I suppose.
But do they fold away, or do you have to slot your gear between them?
No, so it's kind of funny that they just flop forward. Right. But the problem is the third row is the issue. It folds down and you've got to step up like that. So from the boot space to the top of that. So it's kind of challenging. You've got to Tetris your bags in a little bit. And when we travel with all our film kit, especially when Eagle's with me, we've got, you know, sort of five or six cases that go with us anywhere. It can be quite challenging trying to get all that stuff in, especially if you've got a full contingent of people on board.
You've driven it. Mm. What did you think in town?
I was actually quite surprised with how refined it is, because I thought, you know, Mahindra's a tractor company. This car is quite, you know, affordable by class standards. Body on frame four-wheel drives aren't necessarily known for being the plushest and most luxurious cars to drive. But that diesel is really refined. Like, it handles quite nicely in town. It's just like nice light controls. I think that, you know, power delivery and everything's fine. It's got a lot of like Ssangyong-y bits in it as well. So like the indicators sort of sound like xylophones, the display.
You can change that sound.
Yeah.
They're all terrible. None of them sound like an indicator.
Yeah, it sort of sounds like a children's program every time you go left or right. But yeah, I think like, you know, it's a really solid first effort. The main thing is just the lack of safety systems. You know, this is a family focused car. You know, if you're spending lots of time on the open road or in the city, I think you still need to have some form of, you know, active driver assistance available. I know that they're coming, but we still don't know when they're coming. So I think that's probably the biggest hole in its repertoire, is that it doesn't have the things that make it really compete as an alternative to something like an Everest or a Pajero Sport, if you want to go at the more attainable end of things. But, you know, all in all, I think it's, you know, it's a pretty solid car, and I think it fits a purpose for a certain, you know, niche of buyers.
So curious on, I suppose, two things. The first is that price. What else would you be buying for, call it 45 or 50 grand as an alternative? Because I've done some maths on this, and you can't get an Everest for even close to that.
No, you'd be looking at a previous gen used one to get
near or a that. Pajero Sport at the lower end, which is a bigger car but also quite an old car.
Yeah, this feels like it's got a lot more poke than the Pajero Sport. The Pajero Sport feels pretty gutless these days. It's very old engine, single turbo. Like this, the Scorpio has a single turbo as well, but it's just the way they've tuned it is a bit nicer. I don't think there's much in terms of new car. I think a Jimny would be about it. It's definitely not the same
category. If we're talking lack of poke.
Yeah, there's not. Because the Scorpio is pretty capable off-road, and that's the thing. That's I think, what really sells it and makes it such good value is its capability on and off-road. I don't think there's anything that really comes close to that currently that is that sort of price.
Other question is a couple of the software quirks.
Yeah, here we go.
I say quirks, glitches, problems. They're sort of on that scale depending on what you're doing. I drove this thing just around the corner to a meeting nearby where we are in Docklands. And I was stopped at a set of traffic lights, and the start-stop system had the engine turned off.
Yep.
And I thought, that's really annoying. It's quite clunky. So I turned the start-stop system off with the engine off. And rather than just restarting the engine, the car stalled and had to be restarted manually.
Yeah, they did that on purpose, apparently. This is coming from the horse's mouth when we went to Mahindra and spoke to them about it. They said it's part of the design.
Yeah.
Didn't really get a clear explanation as to why. Okay. But yes, essentially, like, all stop-start systems are opt-out. Like, that's just how they work. My routine when I get in, I start the car, I turn that off.
Yeah.
I set my air conditioning, and I'll get to why in a second, and then I drive the car. And you have to sort of do it in that order, because if you don't, exactly that. If you do just rely on that stop-start, it's one of the roughest systems I've ever felt. Like, the whole car shakes. It's very delayed. So if you're in that sort of slow-moving traffic on a motorway or something, you'll end up with four cars coming in front of you because you take that long to actually get going. The air conditioning, the reason I set that is because once you plug in CarPlay, all the air conditioning controls are within the screen. Okay. So you've got the dials, but you can't see the number. So it doesn't then come up. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes air recirculation just turns itself off for no apparent reason. And then sometimes the screen just goes blank and you've got nothing until you start the car again. So it's I don't know why. I know Mahindra does some pretty rigorous testing, as I've seen it.
But yeah, you were there in India.
Yeah, like, I've seen what they do. They do some pretty rigorous testing, but still weird things like that happen that there's no proper explanation for.
I'm going to defend Mahindra here on the start-stop in particular, because I feel like at this point they are trying to transition from, as James said, a tractor company that makes really rugged cars to, I suppose, slotting in almost where the Koreans used to be and building well-equipped, affordable vehicles that come in underneath the existing players. And unfortunately, we're now at a point in Australia and in Europe where you can build a really solid, reliable, rugged car, and then the government goes, hey, by the way, you need to meet these really rigorous standards for all these active safety features you have to have, whether they work or not. the start-stop is, I believe, a requirement in Europe, is it?
I don't think it's a requirement, but it helps brands get underneath thresholds for emissions. And yeah, by the way, the Scorpio has a Euro 6 certified diesel engine, which a lot of its rivals still do not have, which means it has AdBlue, but it also means it's much cleaner. So anyone who's worried about, you know, the nitrous oxides that come out of diesel engines, this system will greatly reduce that, particularly in urban environments where these might spend a lot of their time.
So a lot of that tech has been foisted upon car brands by governments, and it's hard for like Hyundai, Kia, even the big German brands to get it right. We've seen that. We've complained on this podcast about Hyundai safety assists. I just returned a GWM Tank 500 and I really like the car, but the driver monitoring in particular would make me want to just steer it off the road.
You can't, like, if that was my car, I would be removing those parts from the
car. You'd have to tape over it or something like that.
Yeah, it's not good enough.
But you think of Mahindra, which is trying to make this massive shift in the sort of cars it's building, in the fundamentals of the vehicle, and it's delivered on a lot of those. The engine's great, it handles well for that sort of vehicle on the road, it's affordable, it's quite nice inside. On top of that, they're now being asked to develop these systems that are really very intricate that they've not done before. I can understand how there's a little bit of polish lacking in a few of those, and I hope with updates they start tweaking them and fixing them, because they're sort of niggles that take away from what's otherwise a pretty well-packaged car.
Mm. And look, it lives up to the torch that we put it through. I mean, we're not crossing the Simpson on a daily basis, but it does copper hiding. I mean, we do, on our long term, we probably do 8,000 to 10,000 kilometres in 3 months, which is a fair few miles, and it... Yeah, apart from those weird electronic quirks, it's holding up to all of it really well, and it's pretty good on the highway. The fuel economy is pretty good. It does have a tiny tank. I would want to have a bigger tank in it because it's only like 50 litres or something, and you right. churn through that pretty quickly. I'm just pleasantly surprised by it. I didn't think I'd like it as much as I did. So credit to Mahindra. I like tractors. Maybe that's why. But to Mahindra's credit as well, they are in aerospace. So they do everything from tractors to rockets.
It's actually a really big company. I was doing some research on this recently, and they are like, in just as an Indian industrial and sort of technological company, they're huge. I'm not saying they're the same, but they are in India almost what Hyundai is in South Korea, in that they have their fingers in a lot of different pies.
Well, the GDP is in the trillions. It's a huge amount of money that churns through that business in a year. So, yeah, the cars are a very, very, very small part of that business. And for, I guess you could call it an emerging car industry that India is, they're doing pretty well so far. So I'll come back to you once we actually finish the long-term loan with it and see how it actually is. We're going to performance test it and do a couple of things like that, off-roading at Lang Lang in the near future. So I'll let you know how it goes with all of those. That pretty much brings us to the end this week, though. I think we'll do our picks quickly. James, I'll throw to you. What's your pick this week?
So I came across a really fun video of Carlos Sainz and Carlos Sainz driving a Ferrari SF90 on track. Well, it sort of took me back to when you learned to drive. So it started off with Junior in the driver's seat and, you know, Dad saying, slow down here, you know, you're going too fast, watch out for this. And then when they switch it around and the Senior's driving, like the way he was, like Junior's like holding onto the thing, being like, you need to brake here, it's going to drift and everything. I just thought it was a really fun like moment to watch two like really awesome professionals in their own respective sports, you know, driving their hearts out and seeing like the little connection there. I thought it was a fun little video to watch. It'd make you chuckle.
Actually, that just makes me think maybe Carlos Sainz to Alfa Romeo F1 team next year, and you could have Senior in the Stelvio, Junior in the Junior. There's your marketing. You're welcome, Alpha. You can use that. Scott, what's your pick this week?
I've gone something a little bit different to James. It's not nearly as serious. I sent this to you as well, and it's someone who has set up a Mario Kart course on, I want to say, Assetto Corsa or iRacing, and is driving it in modern F1 cars. It is absolute chaos. There's cars flipping. There's cars on their roofs. There's cars off the edge of the mountain. It's just really funny. It's really, really funny watching him try to go around this track and sort of semi-seriously narrate what it's like to take on the Yoshi S's in a Mercedes F1 car. I also really enjoy at the end, there's a section where he comes in and it very clearly has been modelled on Monaco. He's in an F1 car and there's a little chicane at the harbour on the left. And I'd never noticed that in all my years of playing Mario Kart, but just seeing it with an F1 car there, I went, oh, maybe there's some F1 fans in Nintendo headquarters.
Maybe. That video is quite entertaining because F1 cars are ground effect cars. The whole point is they stick to the road. That is completely destroyed.
Yeah, on this totally fictional racetrack. Yes.
My pick this week is, it's an old video, but I've been hanging on to it for a while to be my pick. One of those silly videos where someone goes, I take photos of cars. Can I take photos of your car? But it's actually really cool because this guy has like a original Audi Quattro that's done up in full rally livery, and they go drifting it on a snowfield in somewhere in Lapland, and it is just glorious. That is, I still stand by that as one of the best looking cars of all time, that Audi Quattro, and especially in a rally livery. Got the headlights, got the big wings and scoops, and oh, I would love one of them, but I will never have that much money. All right, before we wrap up, any final thoughts, anything you want to say?
Yeah, I'd actually like to call out some new faces on the Car Expert team. Josh will be joining us next week in place of James because James is away on an event.
He's in the background of James's shot right now. Actually, wave, Josh.
Josh is new to our journo team. We've got another new starter on Monday next week, and then in about 3 weeks' time, there's one more person joining our team. I know that not everyone on the YouTube goes to the Car Expert website, but if you do obviously want to read more about what we've been talking about, head to carexpert.com.au and keep an eye out for those new faces. It's really exciting having some new young journos on the team who are going to be contributing, and you'll be seeing a lot more of them going forward.
Yeah, Josh is doing a cracking job so far. We've put him, we've thrown him in the deep end with some very number-heavy stories. Yeah. So do check them out because, look, there's some great consumer advice in what he's been writing. Absolutely. So, yeah, definitely check it out. James, any final thoughts from you?
The event that Scott mentioned before is the BMW X2 and iX2. So I'm really excited to drive those, particularly the electric one, because I think that's a really interesting car. And I think on the roads of Hobart, it'll be quite a scenic drive as well.
Yeah, might be fast. You're not allowed to go drive fast in Tasmania anymore, but it should be. Yeah, it should be. Hopefully, you do some of the cool. I don't want to say Targa, but Targa roads. Even if it's at a slow 60 kilometres an hour, so they're just such a magical place to drive, Tasmania.
Absolutely.
So I look forward to that, and we will talk about that in an upcoming episode, mostly just to wax lyrical about how beautiful Tasmania is.
Yeah, maybe.
That brings us to the end this week. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We are going to do our very best to be back on a Monday next week. James won't be here because he will be in Tasmania, but Josh is going to join us, and he's going to talk to us about some interesting numbers that he's been working on for some stories on the Car Expert website. So Scott, James, thanks for being here as always. We'll see all of you next week.